Welcome to the podcast, The Exquisite Body of the Soul. I'm Dr. Neil Lundgren. How do we live soulfully in the world? Well, first we need to learn to be present in our bodies, in all the healthy ways that are available to us today. Any of the yogas that connect our mind and body are helpful, as well as being sensitive to what our bodies need, in terms of a balance of the right foods, rest, and exercise. To live in our bodies in a soulful way is an art. When I bring soul, that is my core consciousness, into my experiences, whether they are painful or joyful, I can bring not only positive acceptance, but actual wonderment to my encounters with the world. When you identify yourself more with your soul, you can more easily see your personality, with its weaknesses and strengths, in a broader context that is loaded with significance. Recently, I was speaking with a client of mine, a college student who is trying to regain her balance and live a sober life in order to improve her academic performance and her personal relationships. Part of her felt badly that she'd completed an exam and had decided to not drink or use drugs afterward as a reward. As many of us know, breaking an unhealthy habit pattern when that pattern has its own familiar payoff is not easy. When she was able to verbalize that her decision to celebrate her achievement sober was her own choice and supported by sober friends she'd come to know, this action of self-empowerment helped her pass the evening with her old playmates with more energy and clarity. Bringing soulfulness to an experience is to bring our true selves to the table. To choose to live soulfully is to enter life daily with presence and wakefulness, giving life itself a chance to fill us and to fulfill us. The false self, that part of us that mistakes itself for soul, doesn't perceive the difference between what is finite and limited and what is infinite and unlimited. As individualized souls, we move in the world in two directions. One is toward incarnation in a body, and the other is toward transcendence and beyond the three dimensions of so-called solid objects whose length, width, and height can be measured. The paleontologist theologian Teilhard de Chardin intuited that everything that is possesses some quality of soul, some level of consciousness, some aspect of energy. The soul of things resides in that dimension where inner space, light, or consciousness, intersects the world of hard objects. The 18th century German poet Novalis once penned that the seed of the soul is where the inner world and the outer world meet. Note the poet's use of the word seed. It suggests that in a given lifetime, the soul exists in the body as a potential of consciousness, a seed of awakening that, if nurtured, can bring about a way of seeing and comprehending the universe beyond the five senses. The poet seems to indicate that the soul is a kind of consciousness that peers into what is visible from the invisible. Said in another way, if we're living with an awareness of our soul, the world will shine with mystery, meaning, and purpose. If we're disconnected from our soul, on the other hand, we will live blindly, unconsciously, reacting to everyone and everything from a place of meaningless survival. We will see only a menacing world that we are compelled to either overcome through brute strength and cunning, or one in which we will perceive ourselves as victims, either to be vanquished or abandoned. This is the tragic result of over-identifying oneself with the physical body or the ego mind. Of course, all of this doesn't happen overnight, but over a long period of many bumps and many bruises on the roller coaster of life. Hazrat Inayat Khan, the Sufi sage, defines the lost soul as one who is unconscious of their deeper identity, that they are in fact an individual soul. The lost soul is another way of talking about the self that says, I am only my physical body and my personality, my ego. So, one untethered to their soul, by necessity, must create a defended self that navigates an ocean of ceaseless storms in a chaotic and purposeless universe. Someone closed off to their soul will also attract other unconscious souls who project masks of defense that over time harden like cement with concentrated, dense energy. This frozen energy surrounds and consolidates the mask. The energy that surrounds a lost soul can be quite impressive and foreboding. Who are these people? They are each and every one of us, at least at some moment or even a long stretch of our lives. When we have been overcome by an incomprehensible defeat, a profound loss, where we feel we've lost our sight, our bearings in the world. Whenever we lose touch with our core consciousness, we will be temporarily blind to that core essential goodness in ourselves and in human nature. One who has lost connection with their core goodness will not be able to comprehend the difference between the defended self, who must erect a false mask or persona, and the open self, who is authentic and loyal to its search for meaning and purpose. We need our personas, our masks, in order to play the various roles on the stage of life. But when one of them hardens and becomes cemented, we lose the light that shines from the soul, that's connected by an umbilical thread of energy to its origin. The origin, or the source, as it is sometimes called, continually shines a light that will lead us again and again to the discovery of our basic goodness. When this happens, we'll begin to look for, encourage, and even inspire that basic goodness in others. Once we connect with the essence of ourselves, that is soul, we will begin to recall and to recover our memory of that splendid being of ours behind the disguise, behind those wounds that created the hardened masks in the first place. Every one of our experiences is our teacher. That's why it's important to accept all of them as gifts, even the most painful ones. There is a sacredness of getting a chance, perhaps a number of chances, to travel upon this earth. As we move through this world as souls, having personality experiences, we are always learning. These experiences have something to tell us about the long journey of our soul, the grand parameters of an individualized consciousness that has chosen to narrow and funnel itself into an ego mind. I remember being a sophomore in college and getting into arguments with my philosophy teachers. Back then, I thought I was engaging in this hearty dialogue solely for the sake of wanting to know the truth. And this was partially the case. However, at the time, I was unconscious that when I was a child, my absent father had wounded me often by neglect. Not consciously, but not being able to really see me for who I was, because we were different in many ways. And what I was really wanting from my university profs were their approval and acceptance. All of them, male and female, symbolized my relationship of longing to be blessed by my father. What I was seeking from each of them was a handbook on how to live as an adult, how to be a man. What I needed was a mentor, but like my father, who was one of five hyper-competitive sons, even though I was the only boy in a family of four siblings, I grew to mistrust the world of men, just like him. I coped by developing a mask, pretending to be not only an all-wise know-it-all, but also an angry one at that. By presenting a false sense of superiority, I believed I could keep intact a protective wall around my broken heart. That's what the wounded adolescent does. That's the nature of the wound, and the nature of what will happen when we begin to mistake ourselves for our masks. There's always some kind of pain that we're doing our best to avoid, isn't there? When I was a student, I was so angry and so passionate and so really dedicated, wanting to know the truth of why I had come into the world with this particular set of parents in this particular part of the world. But at the same time, I was afraid to find out the answer. It was almost as if there were two me's. But then one day, many years later, I met a teacher who was both gentle and shrewd. Shrewd enough to see into me, to bless me, and to sit with me and hold space with me in my wounds. His honest acceptance of himself and me pried me open. He allowed me to have my say, let me have my anger that was really only a disguise for my fear and brokenheartedness. He watched in compassion as I wrestled with my demons, and when finally I learned to cry my heart out without shame in his presence, one day he said to me, "Okay, are we ready to learn something else now?" I believe that when the student does meet a genuine teacher in the classroom of life, the student can process all of those pent-up emotions and ask the primary question all of us will at some point ask in our journey. Does what I think and feel really matter? I think the moment this question gets answered, the student, the adult child in all of us, can begin to take off their masks of protection. It is a blessing untold to meet a teacher who allows us to be in our adolescent space and to slowly grow up that wounded and stuck part of ourselves. These are the real guides of our lives, I believe, those seemingly ordinary men and women who give us permission to get in touch with the wound and don't judge us. They make our worlds bigger by bringing light to our darkness and warmth to our cold hideaways. A wise teacher doesn't look at you and say, "You have to do it my way. You have to understand truth the way I'm telling you," but will model to you how to be in the world authentically, by their attitude, by their mood, by their gestures, by their honesty, not by what they say, but how they say it. These are the authentic teachers, the great ones, and our true heroes. If you can just look at one of your masks, one of your personas, which you use in order to conceal and protect your fragile self that hides you from your soul, then you have made solid strides in reconnecting with your true self. It is amazing what grace can happen when we allow ourselves to take the risk with another human being. We can't do it alone because it's too powerful, right? What if I take off the mask or take off the persona that I've trusted in for so long? If I do that, what's going to happen? All sorts of fears invade my psyche. That's the power of all confession when it is done in a safe and empowering context, where two or more are gathered in trust, their soul, that is, loving consciousness, is there in our midst. When we are in the presence of empathy, we can risk that softening of our hardened masks. Then maybe it gets so soft it falls off and we're left with something more real. A callous and impenetrable layer has melted and what separated myself from my soul has fallen away. If I'm going to allow these personas or these masks to come off, I'm going to need something that will contain me, something that will support me when that happens. It is my soul, but not my soul understood as a thing. The American philosopher William James held to a notion of soul that's more like a process than a thing. One could say a becoming or a being of unfoldment. The Indian Sufi mystic Hazrat Inayat Khan called soul a current and said that when science understands electricity, it will also understand the nature of soul. It is not a thing. It is not an object. We've lost sight about what soul is. It is a current that sweeps us, all creation, to and from infinite mind, infinite consciousness. Okay, let's go back to that student I was telling you about, who decided not to celebrate her exams by getting high on alcohol and drugs. Whatever happened to her? Well, when she practiced abstinence for around 30 days, something terribly unsettling occurred. One by one, the personality traits that made her and others around her miserable came flooding to the surface. Selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentment, to name but a few. We're getting close now to what the function of our masks are, aren't we? Masks hide from ourselves what we don't like, but anyone who gets close enough sees right through. We say to ourselves and others, I'm not selfish. What do you mean? I'm not conceited. I'm not the one who's jealous. I'm not careless. I'm not intolerant. I don't have a bad temper. I'm not sarcastic. I'm not the one who's resentful. You are. You see, that's the hard shell of our mask saying all of these things. But once a being has reconnected with its soul, its core self, its higher current of consciousness no longer has to hide from the world or avoid the unavoidable. As Carl Jung said in Modern Man's Search for a Soul, once I begin to look within and see that it is my problem why I'm here on this planet, it is my problem, not your problem, then I begin to live from the body of my soul. If I keep saying it's your problem, I'm putting all of that focus out there and not in here, where it can do the most good. So are we ever totally freed from our ego self, the great masquerader? The original perennial notion of sin, both for the East and West, was separation from our inmost self, that higher self that the Hindus call Purusha and Western mystics call the God within, the Beloved. Our first confession and amend probably needs to be to ourselves. For all those times when I did not bring my soul into my experience, I sincerely apologize. We symbolically, psychically, and energetically go back, don't we? We go back with our memory to heal and to forgive and to uplift those past moments where we can to all of those places where we did not bring soul into our experience. The place where I may have led someone and misguided someone, disrespected someone, misunderstood them, because I was disconnected from my soul. This might be one of our most important jobs to accomplish in this life. Ask yourself, are you an old soul? Of course, an old soul is not necessarily an advanced one. The joke many of us hear batted around is that the old soul is a person who hasn't quite learned from their experience. The point is this. When we begin to see life as our problem, we begin to admit that we have no one to blame anymore. At the same time, we don't blame ourselves either. We just realize that all of a sudden we've landed on this planet and stuff is happening, and we're ducking and traversing the curveballs and minefields of our lives. Hazrat Inayat Khan says, we land here with a lot of information that we've previously gathered. Some of us are blinder than others about this embodied soul that we've come into the world as. And hopefully we meet other beings that can tell us about where we as souls are headed and what the nature of our soul looks and feels like. I've often wondered about the déjà vu experience, that uncanny event that tells us we've been here before. Maybe not exactly in the very same way, but tackling a similar issue in terms of our soul. And our soul is trying to make its way to our body again, and to our mind, and into the center of our heart, where the home of the soul is said to reside. When one of his students asked what the soul was like, Hazrat Inayat Khan answered, "The soul is like the iris of the pupil of the eye, because it accommodates light. It is space that accommodates." Here again, we get a picture of the soul as more likened to a process than a thing, to a current rather to an object in space, and to light rather than a material thing through which and upon which light radiates. Marie Rainer Rilke, my favorite poet, called the flower a muscle of infinite reception because of its ability to absorb light. A muscle of infinite reception. The mind, when it becomes accommodating, opens in discovery. It accommodates new ideas. When the heart accommodates, it becomes generous and giving. And when the soul accommodates, it opens itself up to infinite source. We've all had that feeling, haven't we? All of us have had spiritual experiences where our heart expanded and it went from here to the end of the universe and back again, and we could embrace everyone. Just falling in love could create some temporary moments like that. We've all had those moments where the heart accommodated the soul, and then the soul led it on quite a journey. The problem is, if we go out to another human being without soul, our wounded, injured, and bleeding heart will be leading the show. I could say, "Oh, I want to help you," and someone says, "Shut up, I don't need your help." We must always try our best to respect this kind of fear-based boundary that another person might set. You see, when the heart accommodates the soul, it doesn't mean we immediately need to rescue somebody. It doesn't mean intruding upon another person's classroom of lessons. When the heart accommodates, it is about being compassionate. To be compassionate simply means to be with others in their place of learning, holding space for them. It doesn't mean to rescue or to save anyone. As the mind accommodates new thought, the heart will accommodate deeper feelings of soul that open it up, expand, and stretch it. Here's the bottom line. If the heart learns to accommodate soul, the soul will learn to accommodate what some call God, inmost self, or one could say, infinitely spacious soul. That means that all of that energy we've been using to not reveal that false wounded self, if it were to be repurposed to accommodate the soul, then the soul could use that energy to accommodate infinite consciousness. I have a deep sense that this infinite consciousness is up to something, that infinite consciousness, our inmost self, wants to embed itself into earth, into all things, to transfigure it into most exquisite forms. Einstein called God the principle of benevolence in nature. Framed another way, infinite consciousness has within itself a quality of essential goodness that is always searching for the soul who will accommodate this height, breadth, and depth of goodness. If our souls were to accommodate more and more the principle of essential goodness, it would become infinitely receptive as Rilke's flower to the light, so as to become the splendid beauty it already is, a seed that spreads out into tender folds of exquisite light. To be receptive is to make ourselves vulnerable, open, raw. We don't like that, do we? Because our hearts have been wounded and we've created a shell, a tough and unyielding mask around our tender, broken hearts. But to be receptive to soul, to be receptive to the soulfulness in all things, that is perhaps a perpetual invitation from infinite consciousness to us. Close your eyes and imagine an open flower petal dressed in the silver light of the moon. It's a wonderful image, isn't it? Although the physical body is indeed beautiful in its symmetry, sensuality, and loveliness, I wonder if the body of the soul is even more splendid than 1,000 moons and its accompanying suns. I sit back in the splendor of this silence and bask in this wondrous idea.